People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And I have with me in the studio the young pianist all the way from Romania, Daniel Ciobanu, who recently played Shostakovich's second piano concerto with the Cape Town Philharmonic as part of the autumn symphony season of the Cape Philharmonic Orchestra. And I want to read to you what someone said in a newspaper about Daniel. The Romanian Daniel Ciobanu, who's 23 years old, an extraterrestrial among the competitors, rocker attire, hair tied in a bun, above all, an inspired musician, a colorist, a bewitching inventor. How about that, Daniel? Welcome.
Amen.
Amen to that.
Yes.
We know you here in South Africa because you won the UNISA prize in Pretoria. You got first prize at that. You've won first prize at the BNDS competition in Rio de Janeiro, second prize and audience prize at the Arthur Rubinstein competition in Tel Aviv. All these things and a host of others, you're bristling with awards by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I had, as you've noticed in the first review, it was 23 years old, so I was still running wild like a stallion. But
like a stallion. And how old are you now, may I ask? And you don't have to say it, tell me if you don't want to.
18.
You're going backwards.
Yes, 27.
27, okay. But what I found interesting, so welcome to the studio, Daniel.
Thank
Ciobanu,
you for all having me, for risking to have me here.
Not at all. Oh, do you think I'm in for some surprises?
Well, let's see. Yes.
Okay, Daniel, I discovered after the concert that it was the first time that you'd ever played the Shostakovich Piano Concerto No. 2 when you played it here in Cape Town. Does that add quite a lot of pressure to you when you're debuting a piece, or does it make the concert slightly more tense, or...?
It's a little bit unsettling. Mm-hmm. More unsettling when I'm not sitting at the piano. You know, you get all these demons coming out of your brain asking all sorts of existential dark questions like, do you know, are you sure you know how it starts? And what is this exposition in what key and what modulations? And it's like a Bible of dark thoughts. But actually, it was quite funny because when I found out about this concert, it was actually the conductor Daniel Boyko, which all of a sudden on Facebook, he sent me this very exuberant and euphoric message like, oh, way, you're coming back to Cape Town. And I'm looking forward. I'm also in April in the Cape, so let's meet up. And then I said, okay, well, let's hold our horses for a little bit. What do you mean I'm back in Cape Town? This was in December. And he said, and then he sent me a photo with the poster, with my face, with the program, and saying, and Daniel Ciobanu, 11th of April, blah, 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 Berlioz, and then Shostakovich, second concerto.
You mean you didn't know about it at that point?
It's just like my agent, she has this habit of writing quite biblical emails. And it was like an entire New Testament in one of them, which at some point, as a kind of fine print, she mentioned that the CPO accepted the invitation and with Shost 2. And it was like really a line in between like this forest of other information. And it was also in August when she sent me, which is really the worst month for me brain-wise. I'm preparing for my festival in Romania in September, and August I'm like my secretary, my chef, my masseuse, the pianist, and the cleaner. So a lot of stuff on my head. So I just didn't notice. And then when Daniel wrote to me, of course I was a little bit in shock. And I said, okay, well, let's look at the schedule. So I had to prepare for January Rachmaninoff 2, which was for December to start to boil it. Then in February I had to play for the first time also Beethoven 4th. And in March I had to prepare the Mendelssohn double concerto. So somehow this Shostakovich was like a little spaghetti in between all these other huge mastodons.
A lovely description.
And I'm glad that somehow in the end it got kind of bonded together. Mm-hmm. And it was actually on the stage, I have to say. I was worried that I'm the only one having fun there.
Oh.
And that I'm putting the... I didn't know what's on the other end of the ears, you know, in the public. but it seemed like quite a rapturous applause. So I was delighted about that.
No, and you played a very strange encore as well. For those who were there, just remind us what it was.
It was Ernesto Lecuona, not Enescu. Ernesto Lecuona, Mazurka Glissando.
Ice skating. But the Shostakovich, that piano concerto, I hope you like it now, because you said you were having fun, and it is such fun, isn't it? It's playful, yeah. It's got humor, it's got everything.
It's a lot of notes, which happen a little bit like too simultaneous, almost. It feels like the whole concerto happens on one note, you know, but with this one note has a million inside. Mm-hmm. It has this sort of avalanche, unstoppable until, of course, the second movement, when really time stops and we enter this sort of anti-gravitational territory.
Oh, yes. And everyone loves that movement as well, that second movement.
But you see, this is also what was scaring me a little bit, because I could almost hear the people in the front row humming the theme. And I was like, oh, no, I mean, not in sync with their singing. So in a way, it's the challenge with this movement is to kind of present a version that still sounds familiar to the people, but somehow still keep the suspense of what is he going to do, you know, like something that keeps the attention, not only like you feel the chair in giving you this cozy hug and then you just maybe fall asleep and wake up in the third movement. So I kind of wanted to keep them a little bit still edgy.
Right. I think edgy is actually a very good word to describe the whole performance, because it has the parts of the outer movements which can be quite, I'm going to use the word brittle, but I don't mean it negatively. Spiky, yeah. Brittle. Yeah.
It's and very spiky.
Yeah, spiky.
Spiky piece.
And then that middle movement, you certainly played it with, it was different. It was different somehow from what I'd heard before. And I mean that positively as well. Yeah.
So. Well, I'm glad. So, mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
Yes.
And hopefully you'll come back and now put it in your repertoire and play it all over the world.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, Daniel, as you know, I've asked you to choose some music, and I see you've chosen, you mentioned Beethoven 4, and you've chosen the second movement, the Intermezzo, and I'm most intrigued that you chose that movement, which is more of a, almost like a recitative, in a sense, rather than an actual movement.
Yeah, well, actually, I also am quite fanatic about painting. I do quite a lot of, not necessarily classical painting, but more contemporary installations with all sorts of materials, and because it kind of ignites, like music ignites to me colors and landscapes and a lot of picturesque things in my head, while the paintings ignite to me music.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's a very cool sort of mix, because when I do them, in a week, if I have time to do them both, then I find myself in a very good balance in between these two worlds, and it helps both sides quite a lot. So with this Beethoven, for example, in this second movement, and especially after I learned it, and I felt like, my God, it has this, of course, huge gravitas, you know, like, again, like it's this sort of existential sort of part that it doesn't feel like a note was written extra, quite surprisingly for Beethoven sometimes, given his next concerto. And somehow it was like, almost like I was under a spell when I started to learn it. It felt like I am not almost ready. It was so sacred and so religious music somehow. And anyway, I've learned it, and I felt there is something that I need to kind of caramelize on top of it. And then I found out this beautiful story. This, you know, it's compared to the legend of Orfeo and Eurydice.
That's right.
And that blew me away, because the way it's written and the story with Orfeo going to take the Eurydice, charming the demons with his harp,
yes,
and having this kind of challenge not to look at her until she gets back to the real world from the underworld. And that's when he looks back, you can hear it also in the music. It was like such a clear scenario, like, and I could see it almost like a Vermeer painting, you know, like with all these lights and like choreography, I immediately got goosebumped, and it really put me on the couch, like going for like, I don't know, it felt like 10 minutes, but I think it was like half an hour. I was traveling and doing all this scenario with the music in the head. And when I performed it for the first time, which was in February, I was, I just didn't remember after I played it. You know, it's like, it can really unroot you from reality and take you, like, put you in this kind of legendary, mystical space, which is one of the few pieces, actually, that I ever heard and I ever felt it so vividly and genuinely.
And you felt it in this movement specifically as where we've always told it's, well, in another sort of way, it's like the orchestra is so imperious, the strings, and then the piano is so gentle, trying to persuade, and eventually the strings, the piano persuades the orchestra to calm down, hence your story.
It's also quite related to our usual kind of now sort of life.
Yeah.
You know, like we deal with a lot of like really rigid and sort of unmovable forces in our life, you know, even politically or even emotionally. There are some things that we need to charm our way and to like kind of find the balance. And I think this piece is quite, even if it was written like a few hundred years ago, it's quite active, let's say, in this
let's
world.
Let's listen to the second movement of Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. Thank you. And there you hear, I think, what my guest said about that movement, where the piano actually tames the imperious strings and calms them down and prepares us all for the beautiful last movement. That was the second movement of the Piano Concerto No. 4 by Beethoven with soloist Christian Zimmermann. And my guest here on People of Note is Daniel Ciobanu, the young Romanian pianist who was in Cape Town recently to play Shostakovich's second piano concerto, to great acclaim, Daniel, by the audience here. You know, I was interested just before you started talking about the Beethoven, where you spoke about painting and how it inspires you, and you said something, I mean, you don't just paint pictures on a piece of canvas. It sounds as though you do something typical of you, a little bit more, shall we say, outrageous.
Yes.
Is that fair enough to say?
Rioting.
Riotous, yes. What actually do you do?
Well, it's basically, this sort of abstract world of the piano needs to be somewhere put in concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And after hours and hours of practice, I need a little bit of cucumbers on my ears and on my eyes. So this painting offers me really to, like, immediate solution, like therapy a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, I have a huge working table with all sorts of materials and earth and sewing machines and stuff like this. And I just, I don't know, it's like a refueling, you know, of my energy. Basically, I'm a little bit fascinated by textures, which also I use them in my mind when I play quite a lot, because I think it's something that it can be more general to the public. They can feel when it's, as they say with Chopin, this kind of velvet touch, or like with Prokofiev, or a little bit more metallic. You see, people always compare to materials, not because emotions are quite debatable. And somehow these paintings can really put real materials that I feel on my hand, in my head. I know how they feel, and then I can somehow recreate that musically. So this is why it's a happy mix, happy marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel, have you ever had an exhibition, or do you sell your paintings, or
no,
is it all private?
Well, I mean, I sometimes to my friends, if it's a birthday or something, I offer like gifts.
Okay.
But it's quite difficult. They become like my little children. You know, like, and I,
so you
it's
keep
like
them.
Abandoning them in different places.
Oh my goodness! But so is your where you live? Are you surrounded by your paintings?
Well, usually I do them in Berlin, and then my parents come like maybe once a month to help me clean a little bit the flat, do some motherly cooking. And then I send with them quite a lot back home.
Is Berlin your current base at the moment?
Yes, it's my cave.
Your cave, okay.
Yes.
Why Berlin? I mean, that's listeners will know that I'm a Berlin fanatic. I go to Berlin two or three times a year, and I love it. It's the most extraordinary city.
Yeah.
But why are you in Berlin?
Well, it was quite difficult not to be in Berlin. You know, I was finding myself like floating with my desire to go to listen to a crazy opera or to some. It has this very present scene, you know, everything that happens there, it doesn't, I mean, it comes from a very strong tradition, like the root is very healthy, but the flowering, it's very contemporary somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can find everything also like really traditional with their concerts in Charlottenburg Castle, for example, where there are people still dressing up with wigs and listening to Mozart on a forte piano, and they all start dancing like in a ballroom. And I don't know what happens afterwards, but I hope not what they used to do back in the day. But yeah, you can find everything, really. And it's like so fizzy, such a fizzy scene,
uh-huh.
that it's somehow it does use this huge favor of being really invaded with so much experience and exposure to this, to all sorts of music. Then you really have the liberty to choose, instead of like trying to create in yourself all these scenarios.
Okay. And so you're based in Berlin. Do you travel a fair amount? Are you traveling a lot at the moment?
For the past few years, yes. This is why I don't sprechen Sie Deutsch yet.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
Yes, because I'm around 10 days in Berlin per month.
Oh, okay. Oh, dear. That's far too short.
Yeah, but I make them count. You know?
Right, but where Romania is your home, isn't you? You were born in Romania.
Yes, in the Carpathians.
Okay. And where did the... Apparently your grandfather was a bit of an inspiration for you in the music world.
Yeah, he still is, because he just turned 91, actually.
Oh.
And he's building his own pipe organ now.
But it sounds though your grandfather's a bit strange. You might have picked up, because apparently he cut up a piano or something because it couldn't fit through the door.
Yes, and it was a Belsendorfer. True? Like whenever I go to the country house and I see this Belsendorfer like written on the, he still has the cover of the piano, and I'm always like want to like to cry, you know, like I'm craving to get a Belsendorfer in my apartment, but it's impossible. And it was the same for him. He somehow it's in the middle of nowhere. This Belsendorfer landed, and he was the only one who could have a little bit of knowledge on what is this tool. It's not like a barbecue, or it's not a, I don't know, something to roast corn. So he said, well, it's a piano, it's music. And he said, okay, so then you take it, you know, it seemed like you know what to do with it. But he didn't seem to know what to do with it, because he couldn't fit it anywhere in the house, so he couldn't let it in the rain and or outside, so he just chopped it. And he made an upright out of it.
Good grief.
Yes, it's insane. And he even edited, you know, the strings.
Yes.
Which is like really tough job. There's like, I don't know how many tons of pressure.
Yeah.
But he built this machine, you know, like who could keep the string tensioned and build his little strings for the upright. So the virus in him is very strong.
It sounds like it. I don't know whether to be shocked or whether to be just think it's mad or...
It's a bit of everything, I think. I mean, a lot of everything.
Yeah. And have you played this piano? Have you played
it? Yeah, that's where I started. That's where I touched it first.
Ah, okay.
And I got this sort of feeling that it's... I mean, it sounded terrible. It still sounds terrible. But somehow it was the first kind of machine that would produce some noise when I touched it.
Yes.
So I said, well, let's see how much better I can get off.
I hate that word machine that you keep using, because it makes it sound like something unpleasant, something... Because a machine can be terrifying sometimes.
Yeah, well, it is an instrument.
What's an instrument?
And yes, it's up to us to make it sound like a... Like not an instrument.
Exactly, exactly. And you seem to be coping very well with that, making it not sound like...
Well,
Daniel, what is your next choice? You've had two decisions about your next choice of music. You were going to choose Ravel, La Valse?
Yes. Well, I was thinking La Valse because I did quite a lot of research on this piece. And but then, like, to take a little bit more periodically chronological, also Mussorgsky had... huge impact on my life. I'll just tell you a very short story about this La Valse. Actually, when I learned it, I was in quite a tricky period with my own personal life. It was when the piano career started to kick in a little bit, and I realized, like, my God, this is like, it's not like salon, beautiful joie de vivre. Like, there is really serious work I'm about to be devoured by. And It's something that you cannot postpone, because then the stage guillotine, you see it shaking above your head, and then you regret all these extra hours you took for coffee, the extra lazy mornings. So anyway, I started to feel a little bit this sort of demons that a career can produce. And then I was learning La Valse, actually, so I just started to like finish and start working a little bit on interpretation. And I realized, like, my God, it has this really dark world. There is something disturbing in this piece. And ironically, because it's like so camouflaged in this bon vivant and exactly the joie de vivre of the Viennese waltz. And I said, but why does it go so discrepant? All of a sudden, it's almost like entering an epileptic seizure, you know, and then you go back under the chandelier with all these bubbles around you. And I started to do a little bit of investigation. Of course, musically, it didn't help to listen to recordings, because kind of a lot of people, and even orchestra, they play it as this beautiful piece, instead of like being a little bit challenged by this moment of uncertainty. So I decided to go Sherlock myself and read a little bit about his time when he composed it and blah, blah, blah. So what I found out is that basically in 1909, he loved the Viennese waltz, so he wanted to make La Valse, the waltz, like this huge tribute that would live eternal life. And whenever somebody wants to hear this kind of DJ set, you know, with a lot of waltzes in one, you definitely go to Ravel. So it was in 1909. Then he started in the beginning, as you see also the piece, it's like it has this beautiful caramel, chocolate, and honey, all sorts of different spices of waltzes. And then the First World War kicked in, and he was a little bit manic and patriotic and wanted to go and help the fellow comrades fight. And he was initially he wanted to be a pilot, but he was of course not trained, so he ended up being a lorry driver. And okay, to make a long story short, he started to, I mean, to be a little bit affected, but it's not a pleasant scene. You're not in a spa there in the battlefield. And after a few trips where he had to carry his injured or dead friends back to the safe place, he started to be really like to lose a little bit his mind. He was like a little bit too shocked with this sort of, it's normal. But being an artist, it emphasizes like this emotional sort of pilgrimage that an artist has. It's a little bit more exaggerated somehow, and it's more sensitive. So then he wrote the Tombeau de Couperin, which was a tribute to his friends that he lost in the war. And he came back home and he continued this La Valse. And after taking all this piece that he started before the war, you start to feel when he was finalizing it that somehow it didn't make sense for him anymore. And that's when it gets a little bit frustrating, and all of a sudden there's this moment of breaking point where he kind of almost goes against the joie de vivre, against the beauty of life, and realizes it's all lost, there's no hope, and he destroys this beautiful material in a very tragic way, with this sort of PTSD sort of syndrome that nobody talks about it. And I think like, wow, La Valse is such a beautiful... So it was exactly what it was going also with me, you know, like I started this piano thing as really something I could not resist not doing every day. And then, of course, it's as everything in life, you know, even the things you're very passionate at some point, they start to consume you. And really identifying myself with this kind of like, it has this very beautiful, loving side, but it can also create this kind of demonic and a little bit like hatred. And you start to question if it's really so pure and joyous as you thought in the beginning.
Well, now you've created a bit of a dilemma, because in order to listen to La Valse the way you've explained it, we would need to listen to the whole piece, which is about 15 minutes, isn't it? 15, 16 minutes.
Yeah.
So we'll have to do that another time, and maybe I use your introduction when we play it in another program. But now you've suggested as an alternative, Mussorgsky, Pictures at an Exhibition, The Last Movement.
Yeah,
is that okay? After your beautiful introduction to La Valse.
Well, maybe the public can have a private audition.
Absolutely. Okay, let's listen then to Mikhail Pletnev playing the last movement, The Great Gate of Kiev, from Mussorgsky's Pictures and Exhibition.
Thank you.
mighty Great Gate of Kiev, which ends that suite by Modest Mussorgsky, pictures at an exhibition. In its original piano version, played there by Mikhail Pletnev, and the choice of my guest, Daniel Ciobanu, the young Romanian pianist who dazzled us with Shostakovich 2 some weeks ago. And isn't it interesting, Daniel, you spoke so much about the La Valse, which I'm going to use what you said again to play it. But Ravel famously orchestrated the picture at an exhibition, which is the version most of us know these days, so it's good to hear the piano version there. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you just briefly is, you mentioned you have a festival in Romania. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's like my little baby. It's basically a sort of... I'm a little bit frightened about our audiences, especially at home, that tend to be more, less and less, and more towards very commercial, poppy stuff. So I'm trying to, with this festival, I'm trying to bring young people with like a lot of energy and this sort of like really charming aura, and to kind of resurrect a little bit the classical scene and make it also a little bit more casual in terms of also repertoire and the approach itself. So it's kind of like once a year, it's also a good excuse to be back home and not only sit with my face in the sun, but also with my ears in some good music. And this year, actually, it's quite nice that I managed to do a partnership with the big Enescu festival from Romania, which maybe is the biggest festival in Eastern Europe. And we're going to have a huge gala concert with both Chopin and both Liszt concertos in one night.
That you will be playing?
Not. Oh, thank God, no.
Okay.
No, there are going to be four pianists playing each of the concertos.
So your festival, do you bring in people from elsewhere in the world to perform?
Yeah. It's international artists. Usually my friends that I used to meet at competitions or that we meet in, like, I don't know, piano academies.
Okay.
And actually this year it's a very heavy lineup with like winners of the Tchaikovsky competition and Chopin competition. And actually the people who will play the list are just won the big Utrecht. So it's like a...
And when is the competition, Daniel? When in the year?
The festival.
Yeah. The festival.
In September this year, from 12 to 15.
Okay. Where in Romania?
It's my hometown called Piatra Neamț. It's in the north, in the Carpathian Mountains, quite close to Ukraine, actually.
Okay. So that certainly keeps you busy. I mean, it sounds as though you're very busy, because also just your body language, you're quite active. Your hands do quite a lot of talking.
Yes.
There's an energy that you have. So you seem, therefore, to be very busy. And as you say, learning pieces like this must take a lot of time and energy for you as well.
Yeah, I need to consume all this twin turbo engines that don't seem to stop. So I'm just trying to find the best focus, you know, not to end up on, like, I don't know, hiking India for 3 months, you know, to get rid of all this energy.
But you're going to go on a safari here in South Africa, aren't you?
Yes, finally.
I know we're recording this after your concert, and before you've been on the safari, you say finally. Is this something that you've wanted to do for a while?
Yeah, well, you know, when you say South Africa, it's like when you say Romania, you imagine the fiddlers and the violinists. Mm-hmm. So when you say South Africa, I immediately imagined myself riding a hippopo.
I don't think you should ride a hippo, by
well,
the way.
Just I can try. You know.
I wouldn't if I were you.
But it couldn't happen because in the competition it's... a deadlift there, so you don't think about this. And then the second time I came, it was like quite a tour de force. It was eight concerts in 7 days or something. The maths were not right to introduce a safari. So I said, come on, third time lucky, maybe this time. So somehow I managed to fit it in.
Oh, excellent. And it'll give you a chance to relax as well, if you can relax. And if you are doing that, a three-day safari, do you listen to music or do you forget about music?
Well, I'll just listen to the music of the safari.
Ah, okay. The music of the night.
Exactly.
And also of the animals and of the... Now, you mentioned Enescu, who famously is a Romanian composer, and your next piece is by Enescu, some chamber music. Just tell us what we're going to hear.
Yeah, it's the Enescu Octet for Strings, which is, you will hear the scherzo part, which is my favorite, most diabolical. You will see that my tendency is to go a little bit to this sort of diabolical side of the music.
I see that.
But I'm still taking advantage of this sort of puberty of my brain and ears. Yeah, it's actually, it's one of the pieces that really changed my life. Of course, Ionescu, a compatriot, but also this music, it's a bit like revolution. And also it has this sort of unique flavor. Like you hear it and it's, you don't know where to compare it to or where to put it. It's almost like it has its own universe. And it's even more mind-blowing that he was only 19 when he composed this. And it feels like it's a piece composed by, I don't know, some 300-year-old vampire composer. Vampire. And it's so complex and like mind-blowing that I hope it will be a good discovery for your people, audience.
Music by the Romanian composer George Enescu, part of his octet for strings that was the Scherzo, and another of the choices of my guest, the Romanian pianist Daniel Ciobanu, who is in Cape Town, as I say, dazzling us with Shostakovich too. I was using the word Romanian there, Daniel, and I was surprised when I heard Romanian. I had a Romanian friend for a while, and when I heard him speaking to his family back home, Romanian sounded almost Italian, whereas I expected it to be a Slavic language, but it's a Latin language, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you demonstrate? I mean, I'm going to ask you a question, and then you can answer it in Romanian, and maybe if any Romanians are out there, they'll hear you. Most people won't understand, but okay. I shall ask you a question, but answer it in Romanian. When you're relaxing at home, do you like cooking? Do you like reading? Or what do you do when you relax?
De obicei, seara, îmi comand cina acasă și după mă mai delectez cu un pic de muzică, fac câteva audiții înainte de somn și apoi mai citesc câte o carte sau efectiv meditez și mă opresc, încerc să-mi calmez creierul după o zi destul de the plena.
Okay. Now, just briefly tell me what you said in English. You do when you relax.
Well, I said usually the relaxing starts at night and ends with the sleep. And I usually order. I don't cook, thank God. That's why I'm probably still alive. And my flat is still not on fire. And I order dinner. Then while I eat, I still audition a little bit. Or I hear my recordings from the day and read and meditate and go to bed.
I saw somewhere as well that when you were very young, you were a singer at one stage, weren't you? Or you thought
It was supposed to be my career, actually. Because I was singing when I was four. This guy from my hometown heard me and the pathos with which I was singing. And he said, definitely you need to maintain this fire. But then it went a little bit astray and I ended up having to do completely different.
With the piano.
Yeah.
And now look, your life is, by the sound of it, rich, challenging. You called one of the most exciting pianists on the international concert stage. And Daniel Ciubanu, especially striking for his histrionic and creative musical personality, capable of deep yet refined meditation. And as we approach the end of the program, Daniel, I see your last piece is by Keith Jarrett, who you sort of implied is a bit of a role model for you.
Yeah.
Tell me why you've chosen this, or what is it about Keith Jarrett?
Well, I think what strikes me and what actually shocked me initially with him is that with his current music that he produces, it's almost like dialogue. Really, it's just speech. There's no doubt in my ears that he is not talking to me directly. And especially in this piece that we're going to hear, the Tokyo Encore, it almost, again, it's like poetry. And the fact that he came also from classical music, you can hear that he kind of owned that scene, and now it feels like he broke through in his own way and in his own world with this sort of improvisation and jazz. And I'm more talking about his solo concerts that I'm most struck. Like the standards, it's okay, it's standard. Mm-hmm. But the solo concerts, like the Kyon, the Tokyo, it's like going to church somehow. It's like so sacred and so...
What is the Tokyo Encore that we're going to hear? Is it a piece he wrote, or what is it?
It's an improvisation of his.
Okay.
But you'll see, like, and have some tissues ready, because it's like really deep stuff.
Daniel, it's been fascinating talking to you, because you definitely do have a very interesting personality. And I hope that even with your hair in a bun and the image you project, rock attire and so on, that they say, that the music, the classical music, will still always be there at the core for you to interpret for us and to show us maybe a different... Shine a different
flavor.
Light on a well-known piece.
Yeah, it's what keeps me engaged, you know, to find sort of the tunnels of like the very well-known pieces, but to give you a little bit of ride of in the catacombs as well, not only in the nice side of them.
It could chat you for ages just to hear your opinion on all these things. So much to ask you, but we've run out of time. So let's end now with Keith Jarrett playing the Tokyo Encore. And thank you for your time. Enjoy your safari. And I'm sure we'll see you back here in Cape Town. Daniel Ciubanu.
Thanks for having me, and look forward to our next collision. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Hi, this is Mark Lottering. So I've picked up a pen and written some new jokes, and I'd like you to part with very little cash and come and laugh at them, please, for like a whole 80 minutes at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay from the 12th to the 29th of June. It's called Not a Musical because it's most not a musical. I'm going to wear a tie pin and everything. You're going to be so upset if you miss this. Book now. Theatre on the Bay from the 12th to the 29th of June. FMR.